I'm delighted now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Peter Pesek. He's a tutor at St. John's. He's musician in residence there. He's a pianist, an author. He is the director of the Summer Science Institute, which is beginning this summer for the first time. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte. Thanks for inviting me.
It's my great pleasure. Now, this is something, we had Krishnan Venkatesh on the air the other day, also from St. John's, talking about the Summer Film Institute. Now, yet another addition to the summer curriculum, namely a Summer Science Institute. How did this come about?
Well, it came about, I've been a tutor at St. John's since 1980 and involved a lot in the science part of our curriculum. My background is as a physicist, and I had such a good time and enjoyed it so much that I wanted to do something that would help more people be able to experience it. Many people know about St. John's, know about our seminars and tutorials on the great books centered on students, but they're less well aware of the importance of science and mathematics in our curriculum and the way in which they can be involved and learn in our way. And so this Science Institute is, which is just having its first summer this coming summer, seemed to me a way of opening this up to a larger audience.
And so it's two separate weeks, and people can do one or the other or both? Is that how it works?
Yes, that's right. That's right. It's meant to make it easier either for people in town or out of town to come and participate, because each week is a self-contained unit, but they also have a certain connection between them. They're a little bit like our summer classics program, except they're more intensive. The classes meet twice a day for 2 hours each to give much more time for people to work together and to work intensively through the material, so that the week would form a kind of complete unit that would be satisfying if a person, for instance, were coming from out of town and wanted to experience just one.
Now, the first week is geometry, Euclid, and then non-Euclidean geometry in the form of Lobachevsky.
Yes, that's right, and we call it A Tale of Two Geometries, a little bit playfully. We want to give people an opportunity to experience learning in the St. John's fashion, and this is, I guess, one of the classic and most central parts of what we do. All of our freshmen and graduate students go through Euclid Book 1 and present it at the board, and so that's what we thought we would do. Also, our seniors and also graduate students will look at Lobachevsky, who is one of the founders of non-Euclidean geometry, and he makes an amazing contrast with Euclid. So we'll spend the first couple of days doing Euclid. Participants will go up to the board, present propositions, there'll be discussion, people will help each other out. And then the last 3 days, we'll do the same for Lobachevsky. In his propositions are built, they look very much like Euclid's, except they depart into another, he calls it an imaginary geometry, an imaginary world, in which one of the postulates about parallel lines from Euclid's been suspended, and there's another possibility that opens up. The results are kind of mind-blowing, because the propositions that you get look like Euclid's, but in certain of them, two lines seem to be approaching each other, but they actually never meet, even though they're straight lines, and they seem to be on a collision course. It challenges a lot of our ideas about what we believe, what intuition is, what we think is true, what we think is self-evident, what we think is provable, and the contrast between these two geometries is really what we want to bring forward.
Now, from my memory, which is more remote every day, of being a student at St. John's and studying Euclid and Lobachevsky, was that you have to, in order to understand or visualize Lobachevsky and geometry, you either have to just make a kind of imaginary, just basically say, okay, I believe you and I'll go with what you're saying, or you have to actually visualize it, and it turns out that Lobachevsky and geometry makes sense if instead of having it on a flat plane, you have it on a curved space that looks like the horn of a trumpet.
Yeah, that's right. Even though, and this is the problem, it helps a lot to think of it being on a curved surface, even though Lobachevsky keeps insisting, no, these are straight lines on a plane. So there's this kind of disconnect between thinking of it, well, it makes sense if the space is curved or the surface is curved, and then the other thing that he keeps saying, like, no, this is a plane. We're living in this plane, and these are straight lines. They're not curved lines. So that's one of the great challenges. It makes logical sense, but the pictures keep outraging one's mind and one's visual imagination. So it's a kind of tremendous exercise in freeing the imagination from what we're used to seeing, from the kind of pictures that we're used to seeing. It's funny because our own eye, when you think about it, isn't a flat plane. It's a curved surface with a hole, a blind spot taken out of the middle of it. So what we think are of straight lines on a plane are actually not that at all. Our brain is re-scrambling what's actually arriving in our eye to make it conform to what are now very well-established expectations that we have of Euclidean geometry and straight lines that we've had since we were kids. It was probably only as infants that we experienced how curvy the world really is. And I think studying Lobachevsky enables one to go back to that place before the world had been squared off into straight lines.
Which is at least partially a cultural thing.
Yes, I think it is. I think there are, I've read about cultures, I don't know whether these are myths or true, that in which buildings are built with always curved surfaces, people don't like right-angled corners. Everything wants to be rounded off. We live in a world that's been squared off.
It sounds like Pueblo architecture.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Curved, organic kind of surfaces. So there's that aspect to it. But so this conflict between what's logical, what you can prove, what makes sense in a certain rational way, and what makes sense to the eye, or at least what we're used to. It may be a matter of culture or just habit on our part, is part of what's going on. And all the discussions I've had over the years at St. John's, somehow doing Lobachevsky was one of the most mind-blowing and opening moments when people said, like, wait a minute, that doesn't make sense, even though I see logically that it does. And people have to struggle with things in that way. It, I think, is one of the places where one also understands how much help one has from other people. To hear other people's reaction as they try to explain or express their discomfort with it or explain how they are coming to terms with it or what it would take to come to terms with that world. The curious thing about it, Mary Charlotte, is that that world that seems so imaginary and distant of curved lines, of many lines that don't meet, is actually, if you believe Einstein, the world we live in physically.
Now, that brings us to the second week of the Summer Science Institute at St. John's, where you're talking about relativity.
Yes, exactly. And this is a chance that I thought would be really wonderful for people to go and think of, to read Einstein's own book about relativity that he wrote for an audience of people that he thought, you know, could be read by anybody who had gone to high school. But he was going to try to explain his theory in really understandable language. And for most part, it seems to me he does so. And the book is, I think, one of the great classics of, I don't know, an attempt to explain in common, popular terms a theory that's usually regarded as, you know, incomprehensible or only a kind of mathematical thing that could only be understood by a few people. It seemed to me that this would be wonderful to do because it's a book that cries out to be discussed. Even though Einstein doesn't use equations, he tries to say everything he has to say in pictures or in words. The picture that emerges, as with Lobachevsky, constantly outrages common sense. Meter sticks that are moving seem to be shorter as when they move by you, and the clocks seem to be moving slower. These are conclusions that he gets from reasoning through his fundamental assumptions, but there are conclusions that absolutely seem to violate everything we know about clocks and, you know, yardsticks. And so I thought, in all the classes I had, the most precious part was both people trying to explain what it was that he thought that the argument was, and then struggling with it and trying to say, like, well, does that make any, if that makes sense, how exactly, where do you have to put yourself so this argument makes sense in a way that's not merely just, well, I believe you because you're a famous scientist or something like that, but because it I can start to see how it coheres and makes a kind of a picture that is logically compelling, even though it goes against the things that I see every day in the world around me.
Well, I think it is, it's an important thing to do, and it's something I have not done. I have not gone through that argument. I have not read Einstein, and I think it's probably important to do so. But to me, one of the things it does is it reminds you that what you know only within the scale of your biological being.
And of the experiences that we have in common and what we, either by habit or just a common understanding, think to be true.
Yeah.
But many of those things really aren't true. The moment you go away from that common experience, you let objects travel at very large speeds, or you look at conditions that are very different than the conditions that we're used to living in.
Well, that's what I mean. Objects that travel at speeds that no biological organism could travel at. Distances that are incomprehensible to our sense of what it means to travel.
Right.
It means thinking beyond, really beyond human scale.
Right. Or allowing experiences like traveling in spaceships, which are perfectly possible for us as biological organisms. We could get in a spaceship and power it up to almost the speed of light and make some of the experiments that Einstein talks about. They would take years and years, decades sometimes, to complete, or require incredibly precise things like atomic clocks that could measure billionths of a second. But we could actually experience these things. It's just that we don't experience them driving around in our car, you know, or sitting in the baking co every day.
Exactly. So let's talk for a moment. You've referred a couple of times to the way we do things at St. John's.
Right.
How would you describe that method of teaching and learning?
The thing that's most radical about it is that it's centered on the participants, on the students, not on the tutors, as we call ourselves, because we're not professors or even really teachers. We're kind of co-learners. So what's special about it is that the discussion time is really devoted to the questions and thoughts that the participants have, as opposed to the professor giving a lecture and explaining how it is, and then maybe taking a few questions at the end. We try, each person, to sort of figure it out for ourselves, to explain it as best we can, and where we're having trouble, to try to ask for help from other people. And very often, the other people in the room will say, yes, I have that same question, but I thought of it this way. Or somebody else might have an answer, somebody might say, but I don't understand that. So it's really a conversation between friends, such as what we're having right now, in which two people are both trying to figure something out that is worthy of their time and not easy to understand, filled with problems and difficulties and questions, like Einstein's theory of relativity or what geometry is or could possibly be.
As a tutor who's been doing this at St. John's for 35 years, I would think, I mean, you can say we're co-learners, but you've got a jump of, you know, lifetimes of learning, really, mm-hmm. on the students. And, I mean, there is something that the tutors can bring to it, not just letting the questions happen, mm-hmm. but really inserting a direction and cutting off avenues that aren't going anywhere.
Yes, and to a certain extent we do that. We hope that it will happen in a kind of natural way, as people sort of see, well, this seems to be a dead end. Let's talk about something else. Certainly we try to direct it, but very often in the honesty of our position as tutors is trying to really understand it for ourselves and going back to the beginning as if we hadn't experienced however many years we've been reading Einstein. You know, for me it's been a long time. But every time I go back to him, I'm again struck by wonder, and I'm again struck by both the compelling logic of what he's saying, but also the way in which it challenges my ability to understand, or even makes me wonder what it means to understand actually is. Because understanding Einstein is a different thing than understanding Euclid, or understanding, I don't know what, a work of literature. It involves a different kind of process. And so we try to bring, as tutors, every experience that we've had, which include many false starts, many attempts, many years of thinking about something, as much as possible to try to help people on their way, and also to help to learn from them. Very often, by seeing people's reactions and the places they found difficult, it helped me because I would realize that something that I had taken for granted in the argument actually is a problem that I hadn't thought about, that I had kind of skipped over it or too quickly assumed I understood what was going on. So very often in those classes, the participants have helped me because I've made me think like, no, why is that true? And it made me think again and go back to the beginning. And often some of the best ideas I've had have been in the result of going back and trying to find out, and this is the thing that we do, I think, especially at St. John's, what is the question? What's the problem? What's at stake here? What are we really trying to find out? And what are the difficulties that stand in the way? And we take seriously those difficulties, I think, in a way that many, many other schools don't, or many other approaches to learning in which the idea is, well, it's not that difficult to understand physics. And the difficulties are glossed over or minimized in a certain way, whereas we're kind of interested in what the difficulties are because they indicate actually deep problems that people sense consciously or unconsciously, and that then are really worth trying to figure out, well, what is the nature of this difficulty? What's making this concept or idea so hard to take in? And what would it take to make it more understandable? What would it mean to understand it?
And the process of going through that and going through it over a series of hours and then days and then weeks and then a semester and then, if you're lucky enough to be an undergraduate, 4 years, makes you into a different kind of listener than you came in.
I think so, because when students come in very often as freshmen, they're used to a kind of high school environment in which the idea is to say as many bright things as you can as quickly as possible and maybe defend them against all comers. Very quickly people realize that that's not really either the most productive or certainly not the most pleasant mode of human conversation, which is more a kind of mutual exploration rather than one person beating the other over the head or debating with them and, you know, trying to be king of the hill or something like that. I think gradually people start to realize that it's both possible to express an opinion and then also to question it and to leave it open to other people to give their response or their help without it becoming either a debate or, on the other hand, just total silence in which people lapse into kind of complete perplexity or something like that. The fact that there's a huge human space in which people can wonder about things, make progress through the help very often of reading books or texts or looking at experiments and trying to understand what's going on more clearly, means that they can make steps and they can become more active and more able and nimble to try to find out what's just happened, what are the steps they need to take, where are the difficulties, and what would one have to do to try to surmount them.
After all these years, do you find that there are certain texts where you get to the point where you're like, okay, I get this now?
I don't know. With anything that's at least been important that I've read, it's usually highly problematic. There's some way in which you're having to pay a certain price to reach an insight of great power. So, as with Einstein, I mean, to achieve these insights that he has about space and time, you have to go very far and you have to let go of certain very cherished beliefs and habits of thought. And that sense of what the price is, certainly if there's an unproblematic idea, the price isn't very high. You just could sort of take it in. But usually they're not very interesting. So it seems to me almost any of the really interesting books I've read in science, mathematics, literature, challenge one. And there comes to be a moment where it says, like, okay, like, how much do you want to know? How much of your blood are you going to put into this? And you start to understand the trade-off between the power of the insight and the demand that it makes on you.
Peter Pesek is a tutor at St. John's College. He's the director of the Summer Science Institute, which is beginning this summer for the first time. It's 2 separate weeks. Now, anybody can sign up for it. There's a special discount for people who are teachers.
That's correct.
But it really is open to basically any adult who wants to take the class.
That's right. It really is open to anybody. And we have done over the past 2 years, we've been sort of working up to this and had 2 one-week sessions that were filled by a mix of people, some teachers, but not by any means all. There were people that came from the community, retired people, young people. People just felt that they wanted to have a chance to study science in a new way, not to read a popular book that just sort of lays it out as a series of like razzle-dazzle kind of wonders that you're just sort of invited to gape at. They really wanted to find out, they wanted to go deeper, they wanted to understand, well, like, what's really going on in relativity? What's Einstein's argument? What is he really saying? And so we've had a wonderful time in the last couple of summers, and the group was very diverse, and that's what I'm hoping for this coming summer, too, that we would have all kinds of people. The main thing is a desire to talk to other people, to express one's ideas and difficulties, to ask for help, to listen.
And if you want to find out more about it, ladies and gentlemen, you can go to the St. John's College website, sjc.edu, and look for the Science Institute. You can also call here in Santa Fe, 505-984-6000. Peter Pesek is tutor and musician in residence at St. John's College. He's a pianist and an author. And by the way, Peter, you will be giving a concert this coming Friday, the 6th of March, at 12:10. It's a lunchtime concert at St. John's College in the Great Hall.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, I'm going to play works by Debussy and Chopin. This is something I've been doing here in Santa Fe for about 20 years. It's been a great joy to, about every month or so, play some of the pieces that I've been studying, and in this case, been working through the music of Chopin and Debussy.
And you also have a new book on music and science, and we will be talking about that sometime soon as well. I want to thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte.